Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. So I was.
I'm sitting here at Worldcon with ML Brennan, author of Generation V. And why don't you tell folks who you are and what you do?
All right. I'm ML Brennan, and I've written, you know, my first urban fantasy, Generation V, was my debut novel. It came out in May of this year. And my second book, Iron Knight, will be coming out in January. And I'm just currently finishing up book three of that series right now. In my day job, I teach adjunct work for colleges, just basic, you know, composition for non-majors. So that's about it for me.
You're the second college-level, university-level teacher I've interviewed this con.
Who was the other one?
Nancy Hightower.
Oh, I don't know her yet. I'll have to meet her.
She teaches at CU Boulder.
Ah.
But she's taking a year off and finishing a second book.
That's nice. So, I teach at a little liberal arts private college, and I teach nights at a community college. So okay. I get the full spectrum.
Well, and over on Functional Nerds, my co-host there, John Emilio, is an elementary school music teacher.
Good for him.
So teachers everywhere. Teachers unite.
It was just kind of like, what can we do with this degree to make a little money while we try to write? Yeah, I did a lot of jobs for a while. I was a temp worker, and that was horrible.
Yeah.
I'd get these weird calls, and it would be like, okay, we've got a job for you. You're going to be the night secretary at a school for the emotionally imbalanced. And I'd be like, really? Great. They'd make business dress. And I'd go over there, and I'd be sitting at a desk from like 11 p.m. to 4 a.m.
Wow.
And it was just like, and there was like, it was just me. And, you know, I get weird calls from the, you know, because I was in control of the PA system. And it was so, you know, and it was just like 2 months of that.
And you're thinking, I gotta get out of here.
And I'd be sitting there, and oh god, and my temp, you know, the woman was in charge of all this, because sometimes they'd have to send you on, and usually they just send you a place.
Right.
And you'd be there for like a couple weeks, and you just figure out how to take notes and figure out your way. But sometimes they'd have to send you on an interview, and she'd be like, listen, can you drop your college degree off this resume? I think it's intimidating people. You know, and I'm like, and I just graduated college, and I was like, oh god. You know, it kills you because you're like, oh, I could have gotten this job with a high school degree.
Well, you know what?
My 4 years were well spent.
You know what's really funny? And I try not to hijack interviews and tell my own stories, but
no.
I just got to tell this one really quick.
Yeah.
I don't have a degree.
Uh-huh.
But I've been doing marketing forever.
Great, yeah.
And I've gotten all these jobs, you know, without a college degree. And I was doing marketing for a manufacturer, and the manufacturer was going belly up.
Yeah.
The manufacturer was going belly up.
Yeah.
And another manufacturer in the same industry that I'd been working in for like 15 years.
Yep.
Wanted to know if I'd be willing to come over and work for them. And I'm like, sure.
Yeah.
But then they're looking at me, then the owner's like, well, you don't have a degree. And I said, yeah. So he only wanted to pay me like half what I was making, because his whole thing was you had to have a degree to work for him. So his person that answered the phones, the receptionist, had a degree.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
And he didn't care what the degree was in. He didn't even care if the degree had anything to do with your job. He just wanted you to have a degree.
Yeah.
So he came up with this whole complicated pay scale thing where he was going to hire me, but only if I went to the local school there, the community college, to get a degree in whatever.
Wow.
And my pay would be based on the grades that I would get.
Oh, good grief.
And if I got A's, I would get this much. And if I got B's, I would get this much. And if I got, and this whole thing. And he had this whole plan. And I'm like, dude, I'm not doing any of that.
Yeah.
I don't need to. I can go over here and they'll hire me.
Yeah. Anyway. It's just like I've got the experience here. It's one of those funny things that when I first graduated college, I was all like, yeah, everyone should go to college. Absolutely. After I taught college for a little bit, I was like, no. not everyone should go to college. Because the thing is, you meet a lot of people and they're getting this 4-year degree because they've been told, oh yeah, you need to get a degree.
Right.
And when you actually talk to them about, well, what do you actually want to do? They'll say things like, well, you know, I think I'd be very good at this. And I go, no, you could do that with an associate's degree, or you could do that with this, or, you know, you can go do that with just some on the side training. Why are you spending all this money on this degree? Someone should have told you by now this is not a good path for you. And I mean, I worked at a couple colleges that were just awful in the way that I'd be like, listen, this person should not be here. you know, A, for what they want to do in life, and B, their prep work and grades and all that. And I'd be told, oh, no, you know, what? Why do you have to be the one to tell them this? Or, you know, someone else will be the one to fail them. And I'd be like, that's horrible. You know, I mean, some of these, you know, for-profit colleges can get really, like, predatory, you know, in how they go about it. And it is a little upsetting. You know, that's why I prefer the community college. Just because...
It's just funny because you talk about someone should have told him. I'm thinking back to my high school. My high school counselor was the track coach.
Yeah.
And I think I spent all of 7 minutes in his presence as a guidance counselor. It's like you go in, he's like, what's your elective this year? I picked this one, this one, this one. You know, okay, yep, you're good to go. Here you go. See ya. Good luck.
Yeah.
No guidance.
No, yeah, absolutely. You know, these people, you know, no one actually sat down and did a thorough thing. It's just like, you know, people, you know, who, you know, you get some politicians who are saying, everyone should get a 4-year degree. It's like, no.
Well, these are the same politicians who said everybody should own a house.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Look where that led us. That's delightful. You know, it's just like, listen, it's nice for some people. Absolutely. It's great. But, I mean, a 4-year liberal arts degree, in some cases, is much less useful than, you know, your, you know, technical certificate, you know? And it's just like, Jesus.
Well, a lifetime of fixing Windows computers didn't get me the job as the Windows tech, you know, at the local computer shop because they wanted the AAA certification on there, you know.
Yep.
So has that experience at all, is that, have you kind of pulled that into your writing? Has it influenced your writing at all?
It did. It had a big influence on how I constructed my main character. I mean, part of it was I was kind of, you know, there was a little bit of, I thought, well, there's kind of almost a funny element to some of the things I'm seeing. So my main character, I gave him a film degree, a degree in film theory from an Ivy League. And so basically his job is he's at the coffee shop. You know, he's got like this series of horrific jobs. And he's just like, oh yeah, my 4 years are so useful right now. And I mean, and I have a little bit of fun because of course, I went through, you know, I loved college. I loved my graduate program, but there is a little bit of silliness. You know, in some of these things when you're staying at a department party and everyone's talking about Foucault and everyone's talking about all of these, you know, very interesting things. And it's just like, yeah, you know, we're all going to be working like minimum wage jobs, don't you?
Well, and it's funny because that is what's going on right now.
Absolutely.
You have all these kids graduating college and there's
exactly.
No jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think it's really upsetting, you know, that some of these departments, they'll bring it, you know, they'll be like, yeah, we can expand the department. And I was like, we are graduating so many people who there aren't jobs waiting for them. And some of these people, you know, aren't passionate about this topic. I mean, if you're passionate about a topic, yeah, you're going to be willing to kind of have a couple rough years and maybe find your way. But there's no reason to have 50 people getting an English degree this year. We should narrow this down to, let's say, 20 people and tell the rest of them they really need to get a second major in business or, you know, or in something, you know, that is just going to parlay better. I mean, if I could go back and talk to myself, I'd still get my English degree. I'd still get my creative writing degree, no doubt. I'd also get an accounting degree because I think that could have made my life a little easier for a few years. So, I mean, that was something that I put in that I wanted the character kind of be able to kind of make the jokes that I was feeling myself because I was, I had a very good education I don't regret, but a very expensive education that was making life a little difficult in some ways. I wasn't getting, you know, it's not like you go out and like, aha, yes, your degree is beautiful. Here is your job that you can support yourself on and all that. It's just like, great, here I am stocking groceries or working at a fabric store or doing this or doing that, you know. And a lot of times it was the jobs I'd had in high school that got me the jobs I had post-college. Because I say, oh, yeah, I can tally a till. I did that in high school. And they'd say, great, you'll be perfect for this job.
It's really expensive. It's crazy expensive.
It's so expensive. And, I mean, a lot of times, you know, people are going in, you know, and they're committing to all this, and they're basically being told at every step of the way, it's okay to take these loans. You'll pay it back. You'll do all of this. And it's just like, you know, some people are coming out, you know, like, you know, $100,000 in debt. It's just like, that is going to be around your neck. I mean, 10 years basically after college, you know, I still write a check for every month for student loan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and regardless of whether my job is what I had expected or not, you notes.
And does your character still have to do that too? Is he still paying off his student loans?
I did give him a free ride on that one, but I did want him to financially struggle. So he's got this crappy job at like this coffee place. I mean, he's got awful coworkers. It's sticky. It's unpleasant. It's all, you know, those kind of things. And I want to make sure he's in a crappy apartment, you know, where things are broken. He's got a roommate who skimps on his rent, and my character is kind of having to deal with all of this. You know, my character's car is falling apart, and it seems, I mean, you know, I've got a car like that. It's an 88 Corolla, and I mean, it is nasty when you look at it. I mean, people like look at us when we drive past, and it makes noise, and our bumper's held on with wire ties.
Right,
but it's just like, hey, it's paid off. It runs. We're not taking a car loan to get something else. But I mean, I wanted my character to really be dealing with it. And because, I mean, sometimes you read a series and it's like money comes easy, you know, or it's like all these brand names or it's all this stuff. And I wanted my character to really be someone who, you know, there's a stain on his pants. He's like, I better get, you know, I'll splurge on the OxyClean, you know, and I'll try and get this out. And at the same time, I also contrasted that with his family, who are, you know, they're older and they live in Newport, Rhode Island, and there's this ease and there's this luxury that's part of what he's rejected with his lifestyle. You know, so he's self-supporting doing all this, and they're saying, hey, you can come back at any time, accept how we live and all of this, and your life will be easier, and that's part of what he's rejected. But I also wanted that contrast between, you know, because sometimes you also see how people live can be very different in terms of just, you know, for some people it's just like, well, of course you have a car, and if it's broken, of course you'll just get it fixed, you know, and of course you have nice clothing, whereas for him it's like, well, okay, I ruined a pair of pants. Oh, God, I only have $7 in my wallet. It's Ocean State job lot for me. Let's see what's out there. You know, I wanted to kind of show that contrast where for him, I mean, he's kind of, you know, he's really scrounging. And, you know, money problems are a big part of his life. But he also sees the people whose money is just kind of, it's there and there's an ease to it. You know, so that was something that was really on my mind, because I also see that contrasting some of my, you know, 18-year-olds who are at these very luxurious private college, and I know that some of their parents are, you know, obviously working hard just to keep them there, but I contrast that with some of my community college students who, you know, are in their 40s, they've got a kid, they've got a 40-hour-a-week job, and they're doing school on top of that, and just, you know, my students at the small, you know, liberal arts college, they'll say things like, well, of course everyone owns a laptop. Why shouldn't you just be able to, you know, because I was, you know, talking, I was really upset that at my, when I was doing my taxes this year, there was a document that you could only get online. And I thought that was really outrageous, because they said, this assumes you have internet access, you know, safe internet access. And my students were like, who doesn't have internet at this, you know, private college? Like, who doesn't have internet access? And I was like, a lot of people. That's a bill every month for there are a bunch of people who, to get internet access, you go to a library, and that's not a secure computer. You don't want to type your, you know, social security number into this.
Yep.
You know, and so, but it was just this absolute disconnect between, you know, the community college students who were like, oh yeah, we're angry about that too. A lot of, and the students over here who, that was something they assumed everyone absolutely had. And so there's that kind of really disconnect when you start talking about these basic functions. Like the students over here, you know, in the community college, like, well, what good is the post office for us anymore? I mean, we've got, you know, everything you can do online. I said, yeah, if you have a computer and secure internet access in order to access your bank statement, sure. Or in order to do all these things. But if you don't, you do rely on your bill coming to you through the mail. You know, and things like that. And I was just like, you don't get this. You know, and that's one of the very kind of interesting dichotomies, and it almost seems to be getting further and further apart. So that was, I did want to brush against that when I was writing this book. And I mean, obviously, my main character, he does come out of privilege, and he's living, you know, kind of lean, and he's, you know, he is living on the edge, but he does have a safety hatch. So, I mean, it's not a perfect, you know, setup there, but it was something I wanted to push on that idea, and I thought it was interesting.
Except for the safety hatch and the privilege.
Yeah.
It's Peter Parker the college years.
It is. I mean, that's, yeah, I like when, that every man.
Yeah, when Pete was working at the Daily Bugle, and he was going to school, and he had the really crappy New York apartment.
Yeah.
You know, that he could never pay the rent, and yep. he was constantly like begging, please just buy this picture, because I really need to eat today.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that kind of stuff. It reminds me of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I want it to be like, oh my God, if everything's going on and he's got to go do this thing, you know, to save someone and all that. He's like, oh God, I've got to work today from, you know, from 2 to 8 o'clock. And if I miss that shift, I don't get paid. And if I don't get paid, that is a big problem. I wanted it to be a big problem rather than just kind of like, oh, well, I didn't go into work today or anything like that. I wanted that to be, it means something to him. That when, you know, if he doesn't go into work because he's trying to save someone's life, I wanted that to actually have an impact on his life and be a concern and a worry.
Now, throw in the supernatural element of the urban fantasy.
Yeah, and then you have the, you know, he's a vampire, but I wanted this to be, in the way that I wanted him to struggle financially and I wanted him to struggle in a few other levels, I wanted this to be something where he wasn't someone who was really strong. Physically, I didn't want him to be someone who had a lot of magic. I didn't want him to be someone who walked in the room and I was like, whoa, you know, he can beat us all up. We gotta be careful about that. I mean, like, at the beginning of the book, I have him beaten up by Bruins fans. Like, no magical powers or anything. Like, it's drunken Bruins fans. He's crossing the street and they mug him. Like, that's one of the first things, because I wanted him to be someone who isn't very strong. He's got strong relatives. In a few hundred years, he's going to be really strong too. But right now, he's just an average guy with a lot of baggage, you know, with his family and with some moral elements of, you know, what he's going to have to do to become, you know, when he's a complete vampire and all that. And I made it more biological and more stretched out, you know. But I wanted this to be something where he didn't have anything easy. And, you know, there's a bit of, you know, there's also a little bit of kind of, you know, humiliation to be beaten up by, you know, someone and being like, oh, God, I'm the one in my family who thinks humans shouldn't be prey, and I just got mugged. So I wanted there to be that element where, you know, and also sometimes when a main character goes after, like, your big villain, if they're so overpowered and they've just been getting everything easy, it's like, well, yeah, they're gonna win. I know this. You know, or if they get punched, well, they heal in 5 minutes. That's not really a big deal. I mean, when he gets, you know, he's got, you know, for the whole rest of the book, he's got, like, bruised ribs, and he's like, oh, yeah, I think they cracked a rib when they mugged me, you know. So, I mean, there's also that when he's going through. So I wanted this to be something where when he goes after that main villain, you're like, oh, God, he's going to get the snot kicked out of him. He's going to, you know, I wanted there to be real legitimate danger for him, that he can get hurt and he can break, because to me that makes it kind of more heroic when someone goes and tries to rescue someone. It's kind of that difference between, you know, Batman and Superman.
Right.
You know, Superman gets bashed through a building, he's doing all these things, right? You know, I mean that is heroic and it's amazing. But Batman is the one who, yeah, when, you know, if a mugger punches him, he's got a bruise. He doesn't have all these. Well, yeah, he's got.
I prefer to use the example of Batman, Superman, and Apocalypse.
Ah.
It was a graphic novel.
Yeah.
But and actually, the graphic novel was called Batman, Superman, Supergirl. Ah. But essentially, yeah. Apocalypse takes Supergirl and is going to turn her into a bad person.
Yeah.
So Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Big Bard, they all go to save her.
Yeah.
And while Superman and Wonder Woman are doing all these heroic, you know, superhuman things.
Yeah.
Batman basically rigs the entire planet to explode, walks up to Darkseid and says, if you don't stop this right now, I'm going to blow up the whole planet.
Yeah.
And Darkseid beats the crap out of him and says, turn it off now. Mm-hmm. And he gets the shit kicked out of him.
Yeah.
But he never backs down.
Yeah.
And Darkseid's like, you're the only one who could do this.
Yes.
Because you're the human.
Yes.
And I know
that
you'll actually let the planet explode. He's like, so you have what you want.
Yes. But yeah, it's that kind of element. It's that kind of, there's a fragility there, but there's also more of an understanding than someone who just kind of bounces back after everything and who has kind of, it is more on the line for me, that idea that if he breaks, he's broken.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, oh, tomorrow I'll wake up and go, all right, pop that back into place, I'm ready to go. I mean, I didn't want to, this character isn't smooth. I mean, he's awkward, he's kind of gangly, he's, you know, I wanted him to kind of have elements that I felt, you know, that, you know, there's those moments of, oh, God, you know, he's got a roommate who, you know, is real, you know, who's really smooth, he's, you know, he's smooth talking, he's got, you know, he's doing a PhD in philosophy, so he can kind of talk circles around him, and here's my guy kind of, like, awkward, like, yeah, but, you know,
So like, he's not Bill Compton or Eric Norseman.
Exactly. He's just basically this guy.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and I wanted that element of, you know, this is an everyman. Because, I mean, sometimes it can be hard to kind of really empathize with someone who, you know, is, you know, superhumanly tough. And, like, every member of the opposite gender wants to be there with him, you know, on him, under him, whatever, you know, all that stuff. And I said, here's this guy who his girlfriend's cheating on him. You know, like in the first, you know, part of the, you know, book, he's basically like, yeah, she kind of told me that maybe our relationship would be better if she slept with other people. We're still working through that. You know, so there's, you know, there's also this element to him where, you know, I wanted Edward to kind of kick the shit out of him, you know, on both a personal, kind of professional, physical level, so that at the end, when he kind of, you know, he does kind of make these decisions that, well, I'm going to go try and do what's right, it has meaning. You know, nothing's smooth or easy for him. I mean, he's got a big brother. His brother is older than him. He's this vampire who was born in the Civil War. But, I mean, he does. He's got the chiseled good looks. He's got the good clothes, everything. You know, he's got, you know, everyone's like, whoa, who's that? And then, you know, here's his, you know, my main character, this younger brother, is just like, yeah, then there's me. Yeah. You know, because, I mean, I think, you know, some of us who have, you know, the people around us who we have that feeling of, oh, look at them. And then we kind of look at ourselves and we're like, yeah, there I am. I wanted him to have that feeling, you know, because to me it made him more interesting to me. It made him more fun.
Well, I wish that you had some enthusiasm, you know, the enthusiasm for the character, because so far you've been sitting here very quietly, not saying hardly anything.
Yes.
No, your enthusiasm is coming through.
It's like pulling teeth, isn't it?
Yeah, you're just like, yeah, I want to talk about this character. Let's go.
Yeah.
And that's awesome, you know. Yeah. I love it when the author, even after the book is out, because it's almost like a musician. You know, a musician writes a song.
Oh, yeah.
They record the song.
Yeah. Then
the
they
song,
play it 5,000 times.
And they play it 5 billion times.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they don't want to play it ever again.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get an author and you'll sit down and they're like, they have to remember what they wrote 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because of the publishing cycle. But you're just all over it. You're like, man, yeah, it's this is, and that's awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because, I mean, when I wrote the first book, I mean, I wrote it as it could be a standalone. I left a couple threads where I could come back to it, but I wrote it as a standalone. And I was basically like, well, let's hope this gets published. And if it doesn't, I'm designing my next, you know, potential place. I was building another urban fantasy world and a completely different character and a completely different setting. Because I said, well, there was a point where I was just like, my agent and I were like, well, this isn't selling. And I was like, well, I'll write something new. But then I got the opportunity, you know, then I got bought. They took a 3-book series on it. So I've just finished book 3. And the thing is, every time I write a new book, I'm like, I really like this character. I like where he's going. There are fun things about him. I mean, I gave him this really kind of, you know, snarky sense of humor to him. And I mean, all the places he's going, even as he is, you know, he's developing, he's becoming better able to stand up for himself through the series. But each time I'm like, you know, I wrote a guy who is fun. You know, I wrote, you know, this character on a fundamental level. It's not that he's a nice guy, it's that he's kind of a decent person. You know, it's that, you know, and at the same time, he's surrounded by all of these people who are much more morally, you know, complex, you know, and problematic than he is. But he's having to also be pushed in that direction because that's what his world requires. You know, not easy black or white decisions, but these really tough gray decisions. But there is a sense of kind of, you know, the character's name is Fortitude Scott. And I mean, you know, it's a little cheesy to say, I wanted him to have moral fortitude. I wanted him to have this center of a little bit like Mal Reynolds in Firefly,
right,
where he'll get pushed, he'll do some things that are morally squeaky, but when you get him against the wall, he's gonna make the right call. You know, or he's going to make a tough decision, or he's going to shoot someone who's unarmed, or, you know, things like,
right,
things that are fun, that are neat. But there is this sense of this character has this element to him that there's integrity, there's something interesting there. You know, even while everyone around him is making very morally, you know, tough decisions, and he's having to get pushed in that direction because he's afraid of his own heritage and what that's going to mean, and he's going to have to start, you know, becoming more of a predator and all of these things that right now, because he's so young in a biological sense, he doesn't have to make these decisions yet, but he knows that they're coming around the corner.
Okay.
And so there's a really, you know, there's kind of a fear of biology and heritage in this book. And that was something I really wanted to be part of it. But yeah, I keep having fun with the character. And I mean, when I got the three-book series, I was like, oh God, I hope this is still kind of, you know, I hope this is still fun, you know, on book three. And now, you know, because I was also thinking, oh, I can't really imagine writing a series. I've never written a series before. And now I've just finished book three, and I'm like, oh gosh, I hope they got books. This is so much fun, and I'm pushing him in so many different places, and things are really starting to get complicated for him. So it's very fun.
So Generation V is book one. What's the title of book two?
Iron Knight.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it gets a lot more into kind of the supernatural elements, you know, because it's, you know, it's urban fantasy, so you've got monsters in the city, which is something I really like. And some urban fantasy, it's very open, and you basically have that almost kind of fun alternate history where it's like, okay, if everyone knew about this and it was open and there were these things, where would our society go?
Right.
And that's really cool, and I love that aspect. I took the other avenue, which is kind of that hidden world. And, you know, I don't hide it with magic so much. I hide it kind of with money and with privilege and almost a bit like mob. You know, I treated it a little bit like the mafia. Where there is this, you know, because, you know, my family comes from, you know, half of my family came from New York City, and my grandma would tell me about, oh, yeah, you know, they were the mafia guys, you know, don't ask what your Uncle Lou did.
Right, right, right.
Things like that. There was a little bit of that. So I wanted there to be that element of kind of money and privilege and really nasty things that happen to keep this secret. And there are some people who are in on it. And there are a lot of, but the vast majority of people have no idea of this kind of underbelly. And in book one, he's trying to pretend, he's basically trying to, you know, he's Michael Corleone in the first Godfather.
Right.
Where he's trying to go to college, get the real girlfriend, get away from this family. But in book two, he's gotten really pulled back in. And now he's part of this family. He's having to kind of work on behalf of his family and get involved in things that, you know, his family's like, oh yeah, just kill him. That's easy. Solves the problem. And he's like, no, we got to find another way around this. And they're like, well, you're going to have to grow up sometime. You know, it's that kind of, you know, with his older, you know, with his older siblings and his family, it's this very, you know, it's that interesting thing that I want to play with heritage, but I also want to play with the thing that the people who love you might not be nice people.
Right.
You know, these are people who do horrible, horrible things, but their love for their brother and their son, that is a real thing. But it's a terrible thing at the same time because these are not nice people. And that was something, you know, and he has feelings for them because obviously this is your family, they love you. But at the same time, how many people do they kill?
Right.
You know, so I wanted to really push that. And, you know, I get to push it more in book two.
Very
so
cool.
So that was fun. Yeah.
So book two comes out in January?
Yeah, January 2014.
And do they have a date yet for book three?
Book three is scheduled for November 2014.
Okay.
So everything will be out by Christmas of next year, which is really exciting.
That is, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a pretty aggressive schedule.
Yeah, it was originally scheduled for May of each year. So, but then what happened was my editor called me and she was like, hey, the early reviews on Gen V are really good. People who are reading this are really liking this. We're going to put book two on for January and we're going to move book three up to November. And I was like, great. You know, part of me is also like, whoa, fast. But I mean, it was a good sign that they were really optimistic and people were liking it, which is really exciting.
That is.
Yeah.
It's always exciting.
You hope that people like it.
You do. Yeah, you do. Now, is there anything else going on for ML Brennan? Are you doing any short fiction? Anything else out there on the horizon?
Yeah, pretty much right now it's just the series. I mean, I have a lot of ideas for if I get more books in the 42 Scott series, I'll be writing more books. But I mean, I'm also hoping, you know, to, you know, make at some point get a, you know, a different urban fantasy series going. I like sci-fi. I like, you know, high fantasy, so I might want to play with that at some point. So it's a lot of directions, you know, but right now it's, you know, it's kind of these ones.
Okay.
So.
And are you enjoying Worldcon?
Very much.
Good.
I had a great time last night. I've gotten to meet a lot of people, including you interviewed Django Wexler yesterday.
Yes.
Yeah. It turned out, you know, he and I went to college together. We were in one college writing class. We didn't see or talk to each other after that class. But 10 years later, we both got our first books picked up by Penguin our editors knew each other, and we saw, and we were actually tweeting at each other about Downton Abbey. We had no idea, and I looked at the name on that and the Twitter handle, and I was like, I know a Django Wexler. There can't be two guys with this name. I emailed him. And yeah, it turned out that, yeah, so I've gotten to see him again for the first time in 10 years.
I will tell you, it's a small world sometimes, because John DiNardo at SF Signal.
Yeah.
And Irene Callow at Tor, the art director at Tor, went to the same high school, but never knew each other.
Oh, jeez.
And they really found this out, and it's been like an ongoing thing at the Worldcons. We chat about it.
Yeah.
I saw Irene last night, and I'm like, John's going to be here tomorrow. And she's like, oh, yeah, we went to school, but we didn't know each other.
It's really funny when sometimes, you know, that, you know, come together. I was talking to someone last night, a friend of Django's. She writes a YA series. I sadly cannot remember her name right now, but she was talking because she bumped into the photographer who was at the party, like the professional photographer, and it turned out like they went to school together. And she was like, how did this happen?
It's WorldCon is a great experience. And
and
what I've tried to convey to people who come here for the first time is, if you just sit near the bar long enough, everybody you want to meet will come through.
Yeah. Really?
And you can just say hello.
Yeah, it was actually really fun. I was getting my participant pass, and I mean, you know, how I got into reading was, I'm a younger sibling. My brother's 2 years older than me. And so I would always read his books. You know, he was a very good older sibling. He let me read. Yeah?
Shannon McGuire.
Oh, yeah. I saw her signing yesterday. She's awesome. She's amazing.
She gave me this one.
I know, I want a copy.
So I am, for the listeners, I have a ribbon on my badge that says 2-bit urban fantasy hack.
Yeah.
She also has the one that you need to get.
Uh-huh.
Urban Fantasy Mafia.
Ooh, I like that one. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm gonna have to track her down and, you know, get it. I asked a friend if they could snag a ribbon from her if they saw
She'll
her.
Give them to you. She'll just walk up to her and say hello.
Yeah, if I, you know, get over to her, I'll do it.
So now that we've done the inside baseball thing.
Yeah. So, bad news for everyone who's listening. You can't see what we can see.
Generation V is out from Rock. This is the mass market.
Yeah, this is the mass market.
Yeah. And is the second one, the Iron, is that going to also be?
Yeah, all three are going to be in mass market. So.
Right. And ebook as well?
Yeah, you can get them on the Kindle. And one fun thing is, my editor is Ann Sowards, who does Patricia Briggs and Jim Butcher and Ann Bishop. And so when she picked me up, I was basically like, oh, you do all my heroes.
And how about this?
Yes.
What is your website, your Twitter, your Facebook, all that kind of good stuff?
Awesome. My website is all the usual stuff, www.mlbrennan.com. Mm-hmm. And my Twitter handle is Brennan, and that's B-R-E-N-N-A-N. So it's Brennan ML. So that's my Twitter handle. And the Facebook, similar-ish. The links on my website.
It's similar. Just search my name. You'll find me.
It's along those
I'm
lines.
Out there.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. I hope everybody goes out and checks out Generation V. Before I let you go, is there anything else you want to tell our listeners?
Thank you so much for having me. It's
no
a real pleasure. I really like the podcast.
Good.
So, yeah. And you guys, you know, were Hugo nominated, right?
We are, yeah.
Yeah. So that it was very exciting to meet you.
Thank you. Yeah. Right now, the joke is that the Hugo Award is Schrodinger's cat. Because by the time this goes live, we could either be a winner or a loser. We don't know.
Oh, that's true. This could either be a horrible reminder of tragedy.
No.
Or it could
no, no, no.
be...
It's always an honor to be nominated.
Oh, it's an honor to be nominated,
yeah,
but you want to win. You want to win.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, ML Brennan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal Podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs.
John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day. From weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.